स्थापकाय च धर्मस्य सर्वधर्मस्वरूपिणी अवतार वरिष्ठाय रामकृष्णाय ते नमः. So we have a very interesting subject, Vedanta Unveiled, Timeless Philosophy and Practical Applications. When we look at the history of the world and history of civilization, you find there are two phenomena that work together, they move together. One is a society that needs to change from time to time, every 10-15 years, a new way of life, what you may call a new paradigm, takes over. Paradigm is a concept that originally comes from the Jewish Hebrew prophetic interpretative literature, where for some time a new set of discoveries, new set of revelations dominate. The term was used by Thomas Kuhn to indicate the domination of a set of scientific discoveries that create a dominant theme or a concept for some time, which will give way to another one. Now, in the history of humanity, you find this happening. Society changes from time to time. Its values, its preoccupations, its preferences, all will change. But there are certain values, certain eternal values that they don't change. They never change any time. And the society can sustain itself only if it refuses to alter or change these eternal values, these eternal ideals, which form the foundation of social life, family life, national life. Now, in Indian Vedantic tradition, there were certain values which were frequently forgotten or ignored, as Swami Vivekananda says in his third volume, Colombo Dalmara Lectures. Any nation, any culture that forgets or ignores these values is in for a surprise, and a very unpleasant surprise. This, of course, this also applied to the history of Greco-Roman civilization in a much more disastrous way. Toynbee, the greatest name in 20th century historiography, British historian, he outlines this in his study of history. The history moves in these rhythmic circles of a challenge and response, thesis and antithesis. Certain things emerge and there is a natural response and also a man-made response to those challenges. Frequently, while confronting these challenges, a society may ignore some of the fundamental principles. In the context of Western civilization, maybe the Greco-Roman heritage, originally coming from Greece, and then develop and expand it under the Roman imperial culture, expanded and consolidated, but then eventually that disappeared. Which the result was the Dark Ages. So also in Indian culture. In Indian culture, what we are referring to is not the socio-political paradigm that came and disappeared. We are talking about certain eternal spiritual values. And these values were originally practiced by kings in ancient India, the monarchs. The clearest and most direct reference to this ancient heritage comes from the Gita, where Lord Krishna is talking about an ancient paradigm, an ancient way of life, not for monks or hermits or spiritual seekers, but even for those who were reigning monarchs, philosophers, emperors, administrators. It's called Rajarshi. Rajarshi means a person who is king because he's an active dynamic person, a reigning monarch who has to be active and efficient and dynamic on the one hand. At the same time, if he wants to preserve these ancient values, just to bring in something more unchanging, which is the value of a rishi. Now, Rajarshi is the term used in this tradition. Now, Raja in Sanskrit language implies a king. A king is a symbol of efficiency, has to be a symbol of efficiency, prosperity, richness, wealth, and so on. Success, as we call in modern management language. But then he also has to follow certain values. And these values are meant to help him to continue this ancient tradition. In the context of an individual, you succeed, but also you remain psychologically healthy enough to enjoy the fruits of your own success. In the context of a human being, and let's say a very prosperous person, a very successful person, but not able to enjoy the fruits of his own success because he, in his pursuit of success, he has ignored certain values, and this indifference to values sometimes results in mental breakdown. So in modern times, you can find this happening, anxiety, neurosis, depression, and so on, which are directly the fruits of this the exploitation of nature and also development science and technology. Frequently, when we try to make use of the tools of science and technology, we forget to take care of our own mental health. So these values will help you to preserve, to take care of your mental health. Rajatvam Aishwarya Sambhati Rishitvam Tasyaha Sukshmartha Darsana Kshamatam. This interpretation of a philosopher king, not very different, but still not the same as you find in Plato's Republic, the philosopher king idea. A king is a symbol of prosperity, and a sage is the one who can see beyond success, beyond wealth, beyond empirical achievements, who is aiming at something higher, something transcendental. This is called Rajarshi tradition. In the Gita, in the fourth chapter, those who are interested, you can refer. Imam vivasude yogam pratvanaham avayam vivasvan manave praha manu ikshake abravid evam parampara pratam imam rajasyo viduhu sakale neham hata yogo nashta parantava. So this is a timeless philosophy, so to speak. Gita, fourth chapter. Now, one of the important aspects of this concept was, you, first of all, you don't differentiate between life at the material plane and life at the spiritual plane. Suppose you are told you meditate in the morning 1 hour and evening 1 hour, and then what to do whatever you want, that won't work, because we are dealing with same mind, with one mind, and that mind doesn't change. We cannot split our mind. When we split our mind, we are doing a terrible harm to our mind, to our own personality. This is a very important factor. Now, I can see a trend in modern times. You try to be smooth, smart, happy, friendly outside. And then within, this boiling, these anxieties and worries and hostilities and competitions and jealousies, envies and so on. And we think we can play games with our own mind. We cannot. So mind is frequently compared to an angry dog, not a very pleasant comparison. In the Yoga Sutra literature, in the commentaries, if you feed your mind with good food, buying from the most exotic pet food shops. The dog is very happy. But suppose the same dog, if you feed with stones and thorns, it bites at you. That is true for human mind also. When we play games with our own mind, we are provoking an angry dog. That's our own mind. How does this mind react? How does it display hostility? Anxieties and worries. We call split personality. There is only a psychological term, psychiatric term, to distantly, very inaccurately indicate what I'm talking about. So when we play games with our own mind, what happens is mind becomes our enemy. Mind also becomes a diplomat with us and starts playing diplomacy with us. And this is one problem with modern life, what you call modernism. We cannot express, we do not express everything that we want to express. So what happens is, certain things you forcibly shut down with the mind, but it doesn't disappear. It reappears with a vengeance. And that's one of the reasons for many of these problems of anxiety, worries, and what we call, in a very luxurious cosmetic terminology, the problems of abundance. You have got everything that you can aspire for, but life is a total failure. Not outwardly, your friends may think you are wonderful, you are enjoying life, but you know you are suffering. This is a contrast. So that's why I said earlier, we should not split our mind. We should not create one compartment for prayer and meditation, for external behavior and mannerisms, and another compartment which is within our real personality. So one way to do that, to solve the problem, is to create a bridge between these two apparently contrasting aspects of mind. No, really contrasting. That is, whatever we try to practice or try, whatever we are supposed to practice as part of a spiritual life, should be brought into our material life. I mean, what we call spiritualization of the secular. And in the Gita, this idea is called Sudharma or Sokarma or Karma Yoga. These are all different terms, psychologically implying the same thing. So whatever we do, bring in an element of spirituality so that the spiritual secular differentiation, the line of demarcation, disappears, and the so-called secular becomes spiritual as well. So whatever we do, we're running a shop, working in a hospital, or working 16 hours in a computer laboratory, or an executive traveling all the time, negotiating all the time. In all these activities, which are supposed to be non-spiritual, secular activities, should be done in a spiritual manner. So how do you bring spirituality into the computer laboratory, or the university or the hospital where you are employed? Well, taking care of the patient, or doing work in a computer office, or in a hospital, or a CEO, or in a diplomat in negotiating tables, that is also a spiritual activity, not only prayer. Just as you pray in a church or a temple, you work in a laboratory or an office. So that means the so-called secular is no longer secular, it becomes spiritual. This is the unique paradigm of philosopher king that you find in the Bhagavad Gita, which is far beyond what Plato could have ever thought of. Plato was talking about some element of what he called wisdom in the pre-Augustinian Greek tradition. A wisdom that existed in pre-Christian Greece much more than in post-Christian Europe. And that wisdom had this uniqueness, this broad-mindedness. It was cosmopolitan and universal. But what Plato in the Republic meant was a king should be wise, level-headed, impartial, and he should be even-minded in dealing with everything. That was certainly far beyond Plato's times. But 3,000 years before Plato, in the Gita, Lord Krishna said, this is necessary, but at the same time, how to do it? Do whatever you do. In the Gita itself, you know, it's a dialogue, not in a hermitage, but in a battlefield. Can you imagine a dialogue like this taking place in the current Middle East or Ukraine or anywhere in the world? You can't think of it. It's a symbolic presentation. What it means is, even the obviously unspiritual act of fighting, you can be saved. That's the idea behind. Because for a man who is doing something for a higher cause, it is important to do this as a sacred duty. As a soldier, a social security employee who is supposed to protect, let's say, children from, let's say, from attackers, if he withdraws from his duty and runs away, that is not correct, that is wrong, that's what Krishna said. So Krishna told Arjuna, you should not run away. If you run away, you are worse than a hypocrite. So their fighting becomes a spiritual duty, a spiritual responsibility, as much as contemplation or meditation in a temple or a church. That's the essence of Gita. So in the Gita, Lord Krishna says, so dharma, one's own duty. And that duty could be anything. In the context of Arjuna, it was the duty of a soldier. In the context of Helen Keller, it was the duty of a great person of charity. In the context of a great industrialist who is founding a big trust for helping people around the world, it is a kind of philanthropy. For an administrator, it is doing equal justice to everyone. Or for a mother, it is taking care of children. For children, it is being respectful and caring to parents. So duties and responsibilities, obligations, all can have a spiritual dimension. So it is called sudharma. And when the sudharma ideal is applied in our so-called everyday activities, it brings in a lot of relief from tension, from anxiety, from worry, and also from internal conflicts. As I mentioned, this is in direct contrast to what I said earlier. When you differentiate spiritual life from secular life, it doesn't work because we are creating outer layer around our own mind. We are splitting our own mind into different compartments. With one mind, we are trying to be nice to others, but that doesn't translate into internal peace and harmony. So there should be only one layer for the mind. A diplomat who is shaking hands in an international conference with a hostile nation in heads of state, he may be burning with hostility within. That's okay, if part of his being duty as a diplomat. But we should not do that in our own internal life, in family life, in our emotional life. When we do that, our mind will hit back. As I meant, mind is compared to a dog in one of the commentaries, Jnana Bhikshu's commentary. He's just talking about how our mind reacts to our own actions, our own behavior. So when we try to say something to our mind, you do this, but don't do it with sincerity, then mind will also play the same trick with you. And this this negative response of the mind can result in split personalities, in anxiety neurosis, in problems that we cannot clearly define or understand. So one important point in our life is turning our mind into our best friend. Mind should be our best friend. If mind is our own mind is our enemy, we can never have mental peace. That's why in the Charaka Sutra, there is a statement, Sama Dosha Samagnisa Samadhadu Malakriyaka Prasanna Atmendriya Manaka Sustaka Iti Abhidhiyade. Sustha is the word used, means somebody who is healthy, mentally healthy and physically healthy. The first line deals with the definition of physical health that we are not concerned with. But the second line is very important. Prasanna Atmendriya Manaka Sustaka Iti Abhidhiyade. Prasanna is a word used which literally means contented, full of contentment, serenity, happiness, harmony within. And also you feel a kind of effortlessness, total absence of stress or internal conflict. That state of mind is called prasanna. It is not just happiness. Hi, how are you? Wonderful. No, not that sort of thing. Today, good climate. Nothing of the kind. It is a kind of internal feeling of internal harmony and peace and serenity that we normally don't feel the need to express because it expresses itself. We often express things because it doesn't express itself. So we try to use language to express. So when we are in perfect harmony with our own mind, then that can only reflect in our personality, kind of internal harmony and peace and tranquility. Doesn't seek explanation or proclamation or revelation. That's the real meaning of prasanna. So when we do whatever we do with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, with a sense of sodharma, what happens is mind is always in a state of natural, effortless, spontaneous tranquility and peace. Again, it is not the peace that you enjoy for some time when you go to on a picnic. It's totally different. It is the same thing, but of a much higher quality. It is something that doesn't seek explanation or revelation. We feel deep within, our mind is our own best friend. How do we judge whether our mind is a friend or not? Whenever we try to do something that is obviously good for us, our mind will cooperate. Well, suppose some good discussions are going on in Vedanta society. Give an example. Driving is difficult, long time. Better there is, go take a journey to Yosemite, wonderful place. So. Well, mind is sometimes telling us, why should we care for the spiritual values? These are no use, something. Well, that mind is trying to drag us into great peril. That's because that mind is not our friend. On the other hand, when we try to do something, it need not necessarily be spiritual activity. Going for a walk every day on a regular basis for exercise, procrastination or laziness can be a problem. That is another expression of a hostile mind. That mind is not your friend. A friendly mind is somebody who encourages you, go ahead, when you do something positive. A friend of yours, or so-called friend of yours, who encourages you to take drugs, for example, is certainly not a good friend. Not at all. At that moment, we may think he's a friend, but he's certainly a real enemy, not a good friend. On the other hand, a mind that helps us to be interested in things which are obviously good for our own good, that mind is the best friend. So also, the way we play with our own mind. So one important point in Vedanta is we should have a single layer, not multiple layers, in our own mind. When we put multiple layers, our mind begins to play tricks ourselves. If we play tricks with our own mind, our mind will start playing tricks with ourselves. And the danger is anxiety, neurosis, depression, and bipolar, and so innumerable, which I'm going to give a long list of this. So one way to do that is to bring in an element of sanctity and sacredness into whatever we do, whatever we think. The problem in modern times is science and technology have given us great blessings. They are great tools, great instruments, means for our goods, certainly no doubts. But I frequently mention science and technology together are like a knife. It could be in the hands of a surgeon, where it saves life. It could be in the hands of an assassin, a murderer, where it can take life. So frequently this happens, because nature and its blessings cannot teach us how to make proper use of its gifts. For that we need something beyond understanding the external functions of nature. We should be able to learn how to manage, how to make proper use of, how to avoid making improper use of the blessings of science and technology. For that, we need the spiritual wisdom. And the best way to do that is to bring in an element of sacredness and sanctity into whatever we do. When we try to do this, it's not in our professional life alone, but also in our family life, there is this element of sanctity and sacredness. And another important teaching that Vedanta brings us is something interesting. That is the idea that everything in this world, material world, is momentary, impermanent. This is a very profound idea. Can be terribly misunderstood and used to be misunderstood. Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya. That is like a slogan in Vedanta, Dvaita Vedanta, Shankaracharya. If you read the translation, you'll be horrified. You may be a fit candidate for certification by psychiatrists. Brahman is only reality, this world is unreal. That's why literally, the literal translation, terribly, horribly, confusing really. What it says is this: everything in this world is existing, including the money in the bank, or job, or security, or car, success, everything. But remember, they don't last beyond the limit. Our human body itself cannot last more than 100 years if you live a very healthy life. The money in the bank also have to be left behind when you leave this world. You cannot ask the crematory manager to give back the checkbook and fountain pen. You will be leaving everything behind. This is what Vedanta tells you. This is the wisdom of Shankaracharya. He just reminds us in a very polite, in a wise tone and language, that there is one absolute reality, that is the divine spark within us, within all of us, that is eternal. Everything else, including your body, your health, all the money, bank, house, everything will one day disappear. Which is, you don't have to tell this to anyone. Even a kindergarten child will understand this. Somebody may think, you know, Vedanta says that this tree is not going to last for 1,000,000 years. It doesn't take Vedanta to tell you. Everyone knows that. The problem is we forget it. That's why Vedanta reminds you. It's not that we don't know about it intellectually. We know about it intellectually. But we don't apply this knowledge in our emotional life, in our everyday life, in everyday transactions. You don't ever imagine the Vedanta as something new to tell you. Never. It doesn't say that you are bringing something new which you don't find anywhere else. Vedanta is telling all of us what we all obviously know. Because true knowledge can be new or old. It is eternal. It's only reminding us. What is a reminder? Well, we all know material wealth, empirical success, all these are needed and necessary, but they are not everlasting. It need not be a shock for us. It is simple common sense. It's not philosophy. But it becomes a great philosophy when it makes an effort to remind us of the need to use this wisdom in our everyday life. That's all. It means when you find a medical practitioner, your own medical practice telling you that you have this health problem, you have to take care of it. Vedanta tells you, you do that, you should take care of your health. But don't be shocked if somebody tells you, doctor tells you, your body has some problem. Because every human body should have problems. Otherwise, it's not a human body, it's a granite wall. That's what Vedanta tells you. So Vedanta is just making a restatement of the obvious truth that we all know, that we ought to know. So everything in this world is impermanent, not everlasting, momentary. And Buddha said the same thing. Praditya Samutpada, 12-point link, the same thing. The essential, fundamental momentariness. All worldly empirical things. Incidentally, this is also the real teaching of Nagarjuna. If you read Nagarjuna Madhyamika Karika, we have got classes on the subjects in the YouTube. With Chandragirti's commentary, Prasannapada, you find this one Nagarjuna also, Toshunyavada, the doctrine of emptiness in Buddhism. So also Yogacara system, Vasubandhu, Asanga and others. We have classes in the online system. So what the great teachers told you is a simple truth that we all know. But they just emphasize the point that we should use this wisdom, this knowledge in our everyday emotional life. That's the essence of Vedanta. That's Brahma Satyam Jagat Satyam. That means life, spiritual life need not be a retreat from this life. It can be a way of living this life in a much more intelligent, with greater wisdom, living this life with greater wisdom. I shall try to refer to a few Sanskrit verses which elaborate translations and interpretations. We tell us how in ancient times this Vedantic wisdom was practiced by people in society. This is a book from one of India's ancient philosophers belonging to 2nd century AD. His name is Bhartrhari, who is also one of the arguably is the first linguistic philosopher. So those of you who are interested in higher philosophy find he is the exponent of linguistic non-dualism, the only book, the most ancient book written on the subject of interpreting language as a philosophy. It's called Vakyapadiyam. But I'm not referring to that book. I'm referring to one of his verses. He wrote 300 verses and three sets of 100 verses called Subhashita Trishati. And one of these Niti Sadagam, 100 verses on common sense and wisdom. That's what it is. And it also explains how life should be seen and interpreted from the standpoint of this ancient wisdom. So he says, Aishwaryasya Vibhushanam Sujanata Shaurasya Vaksamyamo Jnanasya Upashama Sudasya Vinayo Vittasya Patre Vyaya Akrodastabasa Kshama Prabhavidur Dharmasya Nirvyajada Sarveshamabhi Sarvakaranamidam Shilam Param Bhushanam. What are the most auspicious, admirable qualities in a human being who combines ancient wisdom with modern realities. So he says, for example, one important quality of a wealthy person is humility. And then one important quality of a man of wisdom and knowledge is self-restraint. And then the most important attribute of a rich person is the willingness to help others for a higher cause. And then one important quality of a strong person is the willingness to practice self-restraint in times of anger. So some of these qualities, I will explain this. I shall read one more verse, then I shall explain. There is a much more important verse where you can see the personality of a man, of a person who has practiced these values. That is, Nindandu Nidhi Nipuna Yidivastu Vandu Lakshmi Sama Vishudu Gachuduva Yatheshtam Addeva Maranamastuva Yugandareva Nyayat Padak Pravijalandi Padanna Dhiraha. Dhiraha means a wise person. If we, let's say, an ideal person, these are values for all times. An ideal person, whom called Dhi means higher wisdom. Higher supreme wisdom is called Dhi. Who is this wise man? He says, Nindandu Nidhi Dibunakha. You are pursuing your own path in life. Some people may blame you, criticize you, try to draw you away from your path. And then some people may praise you. Surprisingly, if you, those who are interested in ancient Western history and philosophy, if you read the teachings of Marcus Aurelius, you find the same thing almost being repeated, Marcus Aurelius. This belongs to the between 1st and 2nd century AD, not too far from time, separate from two different continents, of course. When you follow your own ideal, some people may blame you, some people may praise you, but we should be steady. We should not be overwhelmed either by listening to praise or be drawn from your path under the criticism of somebody else. Lakshmi samabhishudu gacchuduvaya theshtam. Lakshmi is the deity, the goddess of wealth in Hindu Vedantic tradition. So Lakshmi may come or she may go away. Banks may collapse, stock markets may collapse. You may lose money or you may gain a lot of unexpected wealth. Yatheshta, I mean, according to her will. So if you can look upon all these with a degree of detachment, it doesn't mean indifference. It doesn't mean that you should not carefully observe the fluctuation, the trends in stock market. If you are a finance man, you have to do it with all care, attention, with all efficiency. But if you lose some money in the bank, in the stock markets, you should not commit suicide. You should not go depression pills. That's what he says. Go ahead. Because the nature of stock markets to fluctuate, nature of money to come and go, the nature of the world to give you pain and also pleasure, both are temporary, impermanent. They are in a flux. This again is something everyone knows. The problem is, when we actually confront these experiences in our real life, we are not able to use this wisdom while confronting these problems. That's a uniqueness of Vedanta. Vedanta doesn't tell you God some came one day and he said this, you do this or else. No. It tells us something that we all can easily understand, and we all do understand. But we fail to practice in our real life. your emotional life. That's why Lakshmi samavishadu gachaduva yadheshtam. So wealth, the goddess of wealth may come today, may go back, go away tomorrow. We should not be shocked. Again, it doesn't mean indifference or negligence. Not at all. Absolutely no. We should take care of all this, but then we should not be shocked. That's why Lakshmi samavishadu gachadu. The goddess of wealth may come today, go back, disappear tomorrow. Yatheshtam, as it likes, should not be shocked. Addeva va maranamastuva yugantareva nyayat patap pravicharanti pada nadhira. So that is a little hard. One may die today or maybe after 50 years. But a man of ideals, an ideal man, ideal woman for the matter, never deviate from his or her chosen path. That's the meaning here. So here also you find this approach. We are all being told and reminded of what we already know. But we are also told that frequently we forget to make use of our knowledge in our real life situations. And these scriptures are reminding us of the need to practice, not just to read, but to practice in our everyday life situations, to translate knowledge into emotional wisdom. Again, there is just a few, I'm just referring to too many verses, but so there is another one. Manasi vachasikaye punya piyusha purnaha tribhuvanam ugarasheni vipinayantaha paraguna paramanu parvati kritya nityam nijakhrudi vikasanti santi santas kriyantaha. Who are these ideal men we talked about? The philosopher kings. To another description. First of all, so they are good in their mind, in their thoughts, in their emotions, in their words, and also in their body. Goodness within mind can benefit us, as I mentioned, when we have just one layer over our mind. When we have multiple layers, what is happening is it's a very risky thing to do. We are playing games with our own mind. And our mind never forgets. It starts playing games with ours also. The result is anxiety, worries, neurosis, etc. That's why it is said, manasi, vajasi, kai, the physical activities in our words and also in our mind, thoughts, emotions and feelings, we should have the same thought, same ideas, same good feelings. And then, one important thing, paraguna paramanu parvati kriti nityam. When we find somebody else other than ourselves is happy, we should feel happy. This is a very important thing. So, it's very important and very significant. When somebody is happy, somebody is prospering, we should feel happiness. That's one way of turning our mind into a best friend. If a negative feeling towards others, we may think it is our own internal private affair. But your mind is taking care of you, will looking at you. There is a mind within us, and that mind should be a best friend only when we are friendly with others. Frequently, you know, in modern times, we are confronting this problem. People think they can please their God, can be in the good books of their God, meditate on their God, pray to their God, and hate everyone else in the world. That is not how human mind works. When we hate anyone in this world, our own mind is watching. It's like a dog which is being fed with thorns and stones. It bites you. So when we are friendly with others, In mind, that is manasi vachasikaya, means in our mind, words, and the physical activities. When you are friendly with others, then our own mind becomes a best friend. Then paraguna paramanam parvati kriti nityam. When we see good things in others, we should be able to feel internally happy. This is a great verse in Mahabharata. You can imagine more than 100,000 verses in the shorter version. The bigger version, 145,000 verses. That is Mahabharata. So frequently, actually, I'm planning to start a series of lectures on Mahabharata very soon in a Stanford lecture program, 6 o'clock evening. It is next month onwards. So now, Mahabharata is an absolutely astounding repository of wisdom. There is one statement in Vidura. Vidura was a great sage, a philosopher, king. He was actually a king, kingly family, but a saint and philosopher. And there's a discussion going on. Who is your best friend? So, among a few philosophers and sages, so they say, once a person said, well, a best friend is one who helps you when you are in need of his help. When you are in a helpless condition, somebody comes. You know, friend in need, a friend indeed, of course, the old state. But Vidura has a different take on this. Vidura says, no. He's a friend, no doubt, but he's a better friend. So suppose you are in need of, you are suffering, you are in need of help and somebody helping you. Of course, the one who helps you is helping, is your friend, no doubt about it. Somebody is not helping you when you are in need of it, he is capable of helping you but refuses, he is not your friend, obviously. As somebody who is helping you when you are in need of it, he says, certainly he is your friend. Then Vidura says, there is another friend. He says, somebody who is happy when you are happy. Now the problem is, when you are in need of help and a friend comes and helps you, he's helping your friend. But suppose you become more prosperous, more successful than your friend, he may not be happy. Because he wants you to be in a state where you are dependent upon him for help. He doesn't want you to become so successful that he doesn't need his help any longer. So Vidura says, the ideal friend is one who is happy when you are happy. And not necessarily the one who is unhappy when you are unhappy. Because the person who is unhappy when you are unhappy may help you, but he'll be more unhappy when you are happy. So the ideal friend is one who enjoys your success, who feels a great joy when you are no longer in need of his help. That's an important point. That's why paraguna paramanam parvati kriti nityam. Somebody who is enjoying another person's success, another person's prosperity. Nijakhrdi vikasanti santakriyantaka. So nijakhrdi, in his own heart, vikasantaka. In his own heart, he's always feeling this internal happiness when others are happy. So this is the individual aspect of the Radhashi idea. When you practice these two twin ideals, that is the dynamism, the efficiency, the successful life of a king, and also the calm contemplative life of a sage or saint, then you are successful in your professional life. What about your own internal emotional life? There you have to be friends with your own mind. Your mind should be your best friend. And the best way to turn our mind into our best friend is to have a single layer. That is, when we are, others are good, others are happy, we should feel this internal happiness. And also, when we try to do whatever we are trying to do for others, it should be done as a sacred act of spirituality. So that there is no line of demarcation between the secular and spiritual. I mean, even the so-called secular activities can be, should be done in a spiritual manner by practicing everything as swadharma, one's own sacred duty. The secular and spiritual, all are equally sacred. I just tried to give a very, very brief analysis of some of these ancient teachings. So thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.